This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six music. Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the key first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. It's fair to say that today's guest changed the sound of rock music. As a producer, he was behind the desk shaping some of the records that altered the course of music history. Perhaps more than any other producer, his work in the 90s defined alternative rock. He recorded Sonic Youth, L7, The Smashing Pumpkins, and Nevermind by Nirvana. As if that wasn't enough, he's also the drummer and producer of the band Garbage, who've sold millions of records worldwide and continue to play to this day. My guest on The First Time this week is Butch Vig. Here we talk about Butch's earliest musical influences, how Brian David Butch Vig grew up in Wisconsin, surrounded by the music of Frank Sinatra, Herb Albert, and polka music. We also discuss his first gigs, including Steppenwolf, missing the chance to see Jimi Hendrix play live, and his early drumming heroes, plus an obsession with Roxy Music. Butch also discusses how The Clash and punk rock changed his life, and also, obviously, talks about his career as a producer. From the very first time he was in a studio, through to his work with Killdozer and their album 12 Point Buck, and how that drew him to the attention of the Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana. And yes, he talks about the creation of Nevermind, both the earlier sessions before Dave Grohl joined the band, and the recordings that became one of the most important and best albums of all time. We cover the formation and colossal success of Garbage, along with their breakup and eventual reunion, and how perhaps people have re-evaluated quite what a great band they are. But I started by asking Butch, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music as a child?
Wow, that's a good question and quite profound. It would have to be a record that my mom, Betty, played, because she was a music teacher and a singer, and she bought tons of records. It was probably a Frank Sinatra record, you know, when I was like 5 or 6 years old. But she bought pop music too, you know. She bought Beatles records and Tijuana Brass and musicals like West Side Story and Camelot, and so I was exposed to a lot of music. But I seem to remember I don't even remember which song, but I remember she just said how great Frank's voice was. And I was 5 or 6 years old, and it struck me that, yeah, he has a pretty badass voice.
Even at that age, you were like, this is special.
Yeah, and I wish I could remember what song it was. It might have been Strangers in the Night, because for some reason that song has always stuck with me. Da 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 da. That's, you know, it's just got that lovely lilting melody, and I know my mom played that record a lot.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming there was a lot of music in your household, I'm guessing.
Oh man, I was exposed to so much music, and I think it was really good for me, because I've never really felt elitist about music, like I only like one type of music. You know, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and on the local radio they played country music, like George Jones and Johnny Cash, and polka music, because there's a big polka scene in western Wisconsin. And but my mom bought Beatles records, and like I said, every style of music, and so it was a good learning ground for me.
Did you have like a favorite record? Often kids do have like a little favorite record that for some reason just kind of speaks to them, and they find themselves spinning around the living room to one particular tune. Did you have one of those?
Well, before I got into rock and roll, I was into the Tijuana Brass. It's awfully peppy and upbeat. It's hard to be in a bummed out mood when you're listening to the Tijuana Brass. To this day, on New Year's Day, in honor of my mom, whenever I get together with friends, we play Tijuana Brass songs, because she always played that on New Year's Day. We, you know, everybody would be really hungover from partying way too hard the night before, but it's hard to feel bummed out, like I said, even if you have a bad hangover, when you're listening to the Tijuana Brass.
What's the Tijuana Brass? What's the Herp song we should play?
How about The Lonely Bull?
Okay, what about the first single that was yours that you went out and belonged to you rather than anybody else?
I think some of the first singles I remember collecting, in fact, I got all of them, were by Creedence Clearwater Revival. I fell in love with John Fogerty's voice, and they had a lot of big singles out. I think it was probably Susie Q. I remember hearing that in the summer at the local swimming pool. You know, they would play top 40 music, and it just struck me as the groove was really sort of hypnotic and minimal, but his voice, just he had that great raspy voice. And I fell in love with him, and I kind of felt like it was something that I discovered, you know, unlike my friends or my mom, you know, turning me on to music. It's like, I discovered this. So I really got into Creedence Clearwater. And yeah, I had all their singles, man, every single, that was, and all their albums throughout their career, everything that was released. I was a huge fan. Yeah, John Fogerty's voice, man, he brings it too. He's just got that great rasp and growl. And his lyrics also were, you know, somewhat social, political, if you really dig deep into the simplicity of them, like Bad Moon Rising or Who Will Stop the Rain. You know, it's about Vietnam. It's they were pretty amazing social commentary wrapped up in really simple rock songs.
So, I mean, even as a kid, were you kind of aware of, like, obviously, you know, melody and tunes, but you say, was there, I don't know, the quality of the music, how it made you felt, the sounds, were you really aware of that from quite a young age, do you think?
I think I was, and I was really obsessed with it because I would start to pay attention to how arrangements came together, you know, what, you know, when a singer would go high in the chorus or what they would do in the bridge. And again, my mom was pretty responsible for that. She would always point out a melody and say, listen how beautiful that is. And, you know, she typically loved things that moved all over the place, you know, not really monochromatic melodies, but ones that started in one place and ended up in another place. Like MacArthur's Park by Richard Harris, you know, she loved that song. She also loved Paul McCartney a lot because he really also is one of those writers who just had an amazing sense of melody that would just, you know, go all over the place, but it always worked. Paul really has an amazing pop sensibility, and everyone always thought he was the more poppy between him and John Lennon. But some of the tracks, like Helter Skelter, that's Paul singing, you know, and he would really rip it up on some of his vocals too. So I think he was just as, when he wanted to be, he could be just as edgy as John Lennon. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so musically, in terms of playing an instrument, piano was where you started, but then, and this has been talked about before, you had a drumming epiphany, did you not?
I had a drumming epiphany. I was probably about, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11 years old, something like that. I saw The Who on the Smothers Brothers TV show. It was on Sunday nights, and our whole family would sit down and watch it. And The Who came on, and I had no idea who they were, and I was just spellbound. I mean, they played My Generation. It was an incredible performance. They looked fantastic. Keith Moon went crazy on the drums, and then he blew up a half a pound of dynamite in his bass drum or something in the end. And I think it permanently gave Pete Townsend some ringing in his ears from that moment. But once I saw that, I was like, God, I got to do that. And I started just bugging the hell out of my parents to get me a drum kit. And my mom made me promise if I kept up my piano lessons, they'd get me a drum kit for Christmas, which they did. And sadly, I broke my promise. I let the piano fall by the wayside. But I never looked back from when I started playing drums. Within like a year or two, I started playing in some bands, like in neighborhood bands, and then eventually bands in my school.
And how much did you love that kit? Was it? Did you feel an affinity with the tubs straight away?
You know, I love playing the drums, and initially I wanted to be Keith Moon, and I tried to play those parts. I would listen to Who records with headphones on, and sadly, I could not even come close to what Keith Moon can do on the drum kit. In fact, very few drummers can. But I did realize that I could play more like Ringo or Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones, and so I emulated their style. I mean, if you ever listen to me drum with Garbage, I am a pretty basic 4/4 rock drummer, so I think I probably went more in that direction because that's where I knew I could play. And every now and then I'll try and throw in a Keith Moon fill in a show, but it's not as good as Keith Moon, so I don't do it very often.
This is
BBC Radio
6
Music.
Escape with classic comedy on BBC Sounds.
I never realised you could land a chopper on the back of a hippo. It was brilliant.
Like The Boosh, the surreal adventures of zookeepers Howard and Vince.
We lost some animals.
Who did we lose?
No way. Who?
We lost two ocelots and I lost pants.
And take a front row seat for the Flight of the Conchords.
Drink your soup.
It's not soup, right? It's tea.
It's a light soup. Now finish it. It's good for you.
The Kiwi novelty band trying to make it big in the UK.
It's business. It's business time.
Listen to hours of comedy on the BBC Sounds app.
Yeah. Six Music.
Were you one of those kids that saw the equipment and the lights in the audience and thought, that's it. That's what I want to do. I've discovered it now.
Yeah, you know, I just fell in love with rock and roll. And obviously I started playing in bands. I played in a band called Eclipse in high school, and that was the first taste I got of going out to taverns and bars outside, and, you know, usually on country roads out in the middle of nowhere. And we learned a bunch of covers. We learned like Grand Funk Railroad covers and Bad Company and Black Sabbath and Rolling Stones, and we wrote one original song, and that I still remember. It wasn't a very good song, and our singer was not particularly a great singer, but you know, we were really proud of the fact that we did have one original song. We usually played it like three times a night because we would do three sets, so we would always put it somewhere in each set. And I was totally in love. And the great thing about it also, you know, I was like 15 or 16 years old, and we would drive to these little taverns outside in country roads, and there was no one around, so all of our friends would come who were underage, and the bartender or the owner of the club was happy that we were there, you know, so we were all drinking illegally, and he'd invite us back. He goes, I want you guys back next month. So we got a lot of work.
What was your first time in a studio as a musician being recorded? Which is often like a nerve-wracking thing for a band, is like Red Light Fever the first time you go in to try and get something right. What was that for you?
You know, the first time I went into a proper studio was when we did some demos for the band I formed with Duke Erickson, who's now in Garbage with me. We had a band called Spooner which is kind of a new wave garage band. And we went into a studio in Madison to record some demos. And I was, you know, you sort of freeze up a little bit when you hear through the headphones, okay, we're rolling, we're recording. But I was so fascinated with it. That very first session, I asked the engineer like every question, like, what are you doing here? Why are you EQing this way? Why are you putting compression on this? Where are you setting the mics and why are you setting them there? And I was just really fascinated with the whole process and knew that it was something that I wanted to do, even though I never actually had a eureka moment, like, oh, I'm going to be a music producer. I just started absorbing it and wanted to do it. And I still, God, to this day, man, I still love being in a studio. You know, I don't freeze up anymore. I look at it as kind of liberating when you're in a recording studio. Just feel free to, like, express yourself. But it took many years to sort of get to that point.
Obviously, the kind of range of your tastes is pretty broad, but, you know, when it comes to punk, The Clash is a band that means a lot to you. Am I right?
Yeah, I love The Clash. Lennon Collins probably my maybe favorite rock punk record ever. And, you know, when I grew up listening to music and it was playing in bands, I always looked at, like, the Beatles or the Stones or Led Zeppelin as untouchable. They were rock stars. And then when I started playing in Spooner with Duke and Madison, and the whole punk new wave explosion happened, I felt like there was an affinity there. They were my peers. Like, if they could do that, I could do that. And I think that's when I really sort of wanted to start writing more music, and we wanted to make records. And, you know, I just felt like it was a very much a DIY attitude.
What's the Clash song we should play then at this juncture?
Let's hear Spanish Bombs, because that's one of my favorite tracks from Lennon Calling.
Spanish bomb.
In terms of your production work, I mean, Killdozer would seem to be kind of the first, would appear to be the first band you had like an ongoing kind of relationship with, and you started to get, your production work started to get a lot of interest, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, Killdozer were amazing because they were an acquired taste, but they had a very unique sound.
It's true, and, it's very true.
We just hit it off, man. They were really smart and funny guys, and there's a lot of self-deprecation. You know, they took themselves seriously, but not really. There's also a lot of humor in Mike Gerald's lyrics, and they always just let me do whatever. I think that's when I really started to experiment in the studio. Not so much the first Killdozer record, but by the time I did 12 Point Buck, I mean, they sort of said, Butch, this is our white album. It sounds pretty weird. And there were a lot of interesting production ideas on that, and it was just really, really fun to make. And that's the record that caught the ear of Billy Corgan and caught the ear of Kurt Cobain. You know, a lot of indie labels started calling me after they heard that Killdozer record, 12 Point Buck.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have to ask about Nirvana. What's a better question is, what were your first impressions of Kurt and Dave and Chris? What did you think when you first met them?
Well, the first time I met the band, Dave had not joined the band yet. Chad was on drums, and they drove in from Seattle to Smart Studios in Madison to record what was supposed to be a album for Sub Pop. And I think we had 6 or 7 days scheduled, and I thought they were just amazing. They were really genial and funny and engaging. And, you know, it was kind of a rough session because they were tired from doing gigs, and Kurt's voice was already tired just from playing every night, you know, the first day we recorded. The tricky thing was I realized that Kurt had these intense mood swings, and you never knew when he was just going to sort of disappear into his own head. And the first day, I remember we were getting ready to record, and then Kurt just put his guitar down, and he went and sat in the corner, and I said, Kurt, you okay? You need anything? And Chris pulled me aside and said, it's okay, he just gets in these funky moments here, you just got to leave him alone and he'll come out of it. And sure enough, like about an hour and a half later, Kurt just got up, picked up his guitar and said, let's go. And you know, we recorded. So it's, you know, I had to sort of learn how to deal with that, but yeah, they were amazing. Chris just had a funny sense of humor, and there was some tension in that session because Kurt was not particularly always happy with Chad's drumming. And I could just see and feel that tension building. And, you know, so whatever, 6 months later, I think he was out of the band, and that's when they asked Dave Grohl to join.
That was Lithium by Nirvana from the first Sub Pop Nevermind demo sessions that the band did before Dave Grohl joined, recorded in April 1990 in Madison, Wisconsin, by my guest on the first time this week, Butch Vig. And we'll have more from Butch discussing the creation of Nevermind, negotiating with the Smashing Pumpkins, and of course the career of his band Garbage, all after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 2:30. I'm Nikki Cardwell. The Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove says a newspaper claim that Boris Johnson did not take the coronavirus pandemic seriously until it was too late is grotesque. But Mr. Gove admitted that the government had made mistakes in its response to the outbreak and lessons would have to be learned. A government spokesman says ministers are working to ensure that a big consignment of personal protective equipment from Turkey is delivered as soon as possible. The shipment of 84 tonnes of kit had been due to arrive today, but has been delayed. There's growing evidence that the number of deaths linked to coronavirus in care homes may be far higher than those recorded so far. The National Care Forum, which represents not-for-profit providers, estimates that more than 4,000 people have died in residential and nursing homes. Robert Kilgour runs 15 care homes across Scotland.
We've only had 29 residents tested to date, with 17 positives and 6 are awaiting results and 6 were negative. And we've only had 41 staff tested, 14 of which were positive, 21 were negative and 6 are awaiting. We need more testing and we need more testing and more PPE.
Scientists working on a coronavirus vaccine at Oxford University say they're hoping to start clinical trials towards the end of this week. The leader of the team, Professor Sarah Gilbert, says prospects for the jab are very good, though not completely certain. She wants the government to help boost manufacturing capacity so that large amounts of the vaccine can be produced quickly.
So those companies need to have new equipment. They need to have their staff trained in using new protocols and new quality control assessments, and all of that can happen, but the companies that we're going to be working with are going to need to stop doing what they would normally do and make this vaccine instead. So we need support for them all to make sure that that's done in a fair way while they're trying to do something that's really very important.
Six Music News, your next update's in an hour.
Kids for food.
Welcome back to the first time here on Six Music. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the show where we discuss the seminal first moments from an artist's career. And that was, of course, In Bloom by Nirvana, produced by my guest on the first time this week, Butch Vig. In fact, that was the first song he recorded for the Nevermind sessions. Now, the role of a producer is a subtle one, capturing the right performance, but also navigating the individual personalities of a band. Something I asked Butch about in regards to Nirvana.
Yeah, no, I think I was a good fit for them because I had a pop sensibility, and I always encouraged that, you know, to make sure it was really focused in their songs. But I had a punk background, you know, from all the bands like Killdozer and Tar Babies that I had done. And that's what I think, you know, impressed the band more than anything, you know, my punk pedigree. And so the Sub Pop demos are one thing, but when we went in to record Nevermind, Kurt had written these incredibly hooky songs, and I really wanted to make sure that the hooks were really, really focused. And they trusted me. You know, sometimes Kurt wouldn't want to do something, and I usually could figure out a way to convince him to double track his guitar or vocal or to redo something if I thought it could be better. And he did. So it was a good working relationship.
But with Teen Spirit, it was a case of like, oh yeah, okay, we've got something quite special on our hands. It was as immediate as that.
The first time I heard Teen Spirit was in rehearsal in North Hollywood, and I was absolutely floored. You know, I walked in the room and they were setting their gear up, and that's the first time I met Dave Grohl. Dave didn't have any mics on his drums, and both Chris and Kurt had these really loud, they had these incredibly loud amplifiers, and they had mics set on them as well as for their vocal mics. And yet Dave's sound was just as powerful and just kind of floated and just rose above the guitar and bass. And they played the song, and I remember pacing around going, oh my God, this is incredible. It's incredible. And when they were done, they said, what do you think, Butch? And I was like, play it again. I was just trying to sort of get my head around what I would need to do. I didn't have to do very much, you know, arrangement-wise with them on that song. As it turned out, they had been rehearsing every day for 6 months, and they were really tight and really focused. But I knew that from that first day that Teen Spirit was something special.
Let's talk about Roxy Music. If we're talking about some of the bands that have meant a lot to you and kind of playing some of the music from people that have had an influence, there's a fantastic band. Were you a bit of a Roxy obsessive?
I was the president of the Roxy Music fan club in Madison, Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there were only 7 members. It was a small club. I was the self-appointed president. Every month, one Saturday a month, we would have Roxy-thons. My sophomore year at film school at the University of Wisconsin, I lived in this 7-bedroom house. It was very much like Animal House. You know, we were all, it was in disarray, and there were parties there constantly. But we had Roxy-thons every one Saturday night a month, and we would all dress up like the members of Roxy Music. You know, very glammy, and we would
dress up
all the Roxy
amazing
albums. Yeah, I usually preferred to be Brian Ferry, but sometimes I would dress up like Phil Manzanera or Brian Eno, and it was fun, man. And we had all the Roxy albums, plus all their solo albums, plus these live bootlegs. You know, it was amazingly fun, and I still love the band to this day. I think their records are phenomenal.
Big time. Take me on a roller coaster. Take me for anything. yeah, you're so chic. Do you ever love me? Just me too, got to search for something new.
Talking about that relationship between musicians and producers, working with the Smashing Pumpkins, working with Billy Corgan, but I imagine in the studio, like, a hard taskmaster, a man who knows what he wants, shall we say. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, Billy has a really strong vision, and he's very, very driven, but I love working with him. You know, he and I think, found mutual partners in how we could push ourselves and raise the bar. And when I made Gish, that was like the first proper budget I'd ever had for a record. I think we had about 25 or 30 days to record and mix it. And that was amazing. You know, to me, that was like making a Steely Dan record, because I'd made all these 1 or 2 or 3 day punk rock records. And so, you know, we made Gish, and that did really well. And then we went to make Siamese Dream, and we had a lot of talks before we went in terms of production, what we wanted to do. And we really, like I said, we really pushed each other to raise the bar high. Siamese Dream was a really difficult record to make, because the band was in disarray at each other's throats. And, you know, this is before computers, and we sort of were perfectionists. And also just searching for interesting things sonically in the studio. So, you know, we did 6 days a week, like 14 or 15 hour days. And it was 5 months of recording. The last 2 months, we worked 7 days a week. And then we came to L.A. And brought Alan Moulder in to mix. And we mixed 6 straight weeks every day. So it was kind of crazy. I think the record still sounds great, but I just remember how fried out I was afterwards. We'll be right back.
Six Music.
I feel like I shouldn't play this, but I'm going to play it anyway.
Star of Peaky Blinders.
Lots of brilliant new music out there.
Cillian Murphy.
But there are many more yet to be discovered. I thought my earphones were broken because the production of it is huge. It sounds like the bass is exploding in your head.
Sharing his musical passions through his extensive collection.
It makes you think a little bit about Kid A, I suppose, and what Radiohead were doing all those years ago. That's the beauty of this radio station. You can play two tracks like that back to back, and it gives me an awful lot of pleasure to hear them like that.
This is Cillian Murphy.
I urge you to listen to that record. It's really special.
Available now on the BBC Sounds app.
Six Music.
Six Music.
Talking about other important firsts, we should talk about your first impressions of Shirley when your paths first cross.
Well, Duke and Steve and I had been working on some garbage music for about 4 or 5 months, and we knew we wanted to find a female singer and hadn't really, found the right person or the right fit. And Steve happened to tape 120 minutes on MTV every Sunday night, and he came in on Monday and said, "There's the singer from this band Angelfish, and I really like this track." And we watched it on the videotape. It was the song Suffocate Me. And we're all struck by how intense it was, but how understated it was. Like, instead of screaming and blowing your voice out like a lot of alternative singers were doing at the time, she did the complete opposite. So we called her up and said, "Hey, we got these songs. Do you want to maybe meet and see if there's some chemistry and you want to sing on a track or two?" You know, we had no plans of even doing a full album at that time. And so we flew to England. And we went to some posh hotel. We weren't staying there, but Shirley thought we were, staying at some posh hotel. But that's where we met for tea and some gin and tonics. And we had a really great 3 or 4 hour meeting talking about books and music and food and culture and politics. And we invited her to come to Madison to record. And I left and I went back to the hotel. And then I went out to meet Flood and Alan Mulder and a bunch of other producers and engineers. I was just going to enjoy a night out. And when I got there, they were all staring at me, and they said, "Did you hear what happened?" I said, "No." And they said, "Kurt Cobain is dead." And I just kind of freaked out. I had to go back to the hotel and just immediately fly back to the States. And looking back, it's pretty weird, but that is a big turning point in my career. Like, literally, it's like from one part of my career changed into another part, and on the same day, really.
I didn't realize it was the same day. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's very strange, but it's true. It's like the passing of the torch happened, and I guess I didn't even realize that at the time, but it did.
When was the point with Garbage when you first felt it kind of connect? You know, because with a band's career, like, they set out with a certain amount of intent, and it takes them a while, and then all of a sudden, as you say, like, it kind of catches fire. People get it, and maybe there's that one song or that one concert when you think, yeah, okay. This is about to go off now. This is about to happen. Could you remember that point and first thinking that was happening?
It was probably one of the first shows that we did. I can't remember which one, but we started out in the Midwest on the tour. We played 7th Street Entry, which is downstairs from Prince's Club, First Avenue in Minneapolis. And there was a small crowd, but very quickly, the crowds every night were going from like 200 to 300, 300 to 500, 500 to 800, 800 to 1,000. And in some cases, they bumped us up to bigger venues. And really, it was all because of the airplay of Vow on alternative radio. We shot the video for Vow with Sam Baer, a director who we've worked with a bunch of times. He also did Nevermind, by the way, so there was a history there. We went to LA to shoot Vow. And that was the first time that we had ever played together in a room, even though we weren't playing, we were lip-syncing. And the four of us, after spending all day shooting the film, shooting the video, we kind of looked at each other and went, "We can do this, we can do this." Because I think we were all a little nervous about, can we go out and play these songs live? And then I think that gave us a lot of confidence. So, but very quickly, the shows, the tour dates, start getting packed. It might have been the Metro in Chicago, which is a packed show, and people were just, the record had just come out, and people were singing along to all the songs on the record, which was kind of blowing our minds.
Six Music.
When I grow up, I'll be stable. When I grow up, I'll turn the tables.
It's interesting with Garbage because there's like not many bands that have been had a career that long haven't kind of had like a proper, well, we're going to disband for a bit or we're going to stop for a bit. You've always kind of, you've always been there, you know? You've all done different stuff, but Garbage has always kind of remained a concern running in the background. Why do you think that is? Do you think that's just because you care about it so much, or that you, as people, you're able to like want to keep working with each other?
You know, I think Garbage for the four of us has been a great creative outlet. Part of that is that we all have a lot of different roles. You know, I'm not just the drummer or I'm not just the producer. I can engineer and come up with weird sounds. I can play bass or keyboards or guitar, and I can bring in a song idea. I can order dinner and go pick up the wine, and that is the same for all four of us. You know, we all share all those same duties, and so from a creative standpoint, it's been very flexible. You know, I think all of us can stretch our wings, and that, and the fact that you know, I think we have a really strong sensibility and a vision that we share, and I can't even quite articulate it, but when, you know, for better or for worse, when you hear a Garbage record, it sounds like us. I think even if we try to not sound like Garbage, we still sound like Garbage. And I think we sort of take that as a plus now, you know. And even if we tried to reinvent ourselves, we would still, for better or for worse, sound like Garbage.
We always ask everybody to pick the final song. It could be anything you want. What would you like to go out on?
You know what? I'm gonna give our 5 Billion of Diamonds album a plug and play Gravity Rules.
Why that song?
Well, I think it's the first track on the record, and it kind of sets a tone for what we're doing. It features Ebbett Lumberg, the singer from Soundtrack of Our Lives, who is a total rock god, by the way. And James and Andy and I came up with the music for the track, and Ebbett wrote the lyrics and sings on it. And it's a really cool track because it's quite vulnerable in spots how he sings it, but then it has this glorious, almost Beach Boys cascading vocals that come in the choruses, and we're really chuffed with how it turned out, and it's the first thing anybody heard from 5 Billion of Diamonds, so let's give that a spin.
And that's the song we should finish on. Thank you very much, man.
Yeah, Matt, thanks. This is really fun, man. I'm glad we got to chat.
That was Gravity Rules from 2017 by the band 5 Billion in Diamonds, who include in their number my guest here on the First Time this week, Butch Vig. So as we speak, there's lots of first-time podcasts to download on BBC Sounds, including Tom York, Dave Grohl, Liam Gallagher, Florence Welsh, and there's lots of other shows from the archive to stream up there as well. And we've got Portishead, Sinead O'Connor, Mick Jones, Debbie Harry, Brian Ferry, and many, many more, all, as I say, up on BBC Sounds. I'll be back next week with a brand new first time with a Hollywood A-list actor who's also an acclaimed jazz pianist. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
Right now, it's Guy Garvey's finest hour.
Good afternoon, Mr. Garvey.